Progressive Reason Broadcast Network presents The Heretics Hour with Carolyn Yeager. Carolyn Yeager brings you news and commentary on Holocaust revisionism, World War II history, free speech issues, and more. And now, here's Carolyn.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. I'm Carolyn Yeager. Before I launch into tonight's show, I want to direct a little attention to my Elie Wiesel Kanza World website, which is at www.elieweaseltattoo.com. Interesting developments newly written about are that I discovered that the so-called Holocaust is taught at Boston University, where Elie has been a professor for a long time, only in the Department of Religion, not in the History Department. I wrote a blog explaining why this is, and many other things about the Department of Religion at BU. Also of interest is the news that a special fellowship has been created for Elie Wiesel at Chapman University in Orange, California. This is a smallish private university where the Holocaust has become an increasingly important theme of the curriculum over the past 10 or 15 years or so, maybe not that many. Chapman has its own Department of Holocaust, if you will, in the Rogers Center for Holocaust Education, where you can earn a history minor in Holocaust, and which includes a Holocaust library and an annual Holocaust art and writing contest. It is this center complex that Elie Wiesel will be visiting each spring for the next 4 years as a newly appointed Distinguished Presidential Fellow. Read about it at the website, where I will soon write more on many Holocaust-related courses which are offered at Chapman in the Religion and History departments, or in both. And also check out opportunities for activism. If you're near Boston University, you can still attend a free lecture by the Wiesel next Monday night, November 8th. I hope you listened to last week's special 24-hour presentation in preparation for tonight's show, or if you haven't yet, that you will after you hear this program. I know it's not fun listening when you're hearing the worst things that can happen to people, but it's important listening, and I'm going to tell you why. What is happening to us today in America, meaning the U.S. and Canada, in Europe, in the United Kingdom, was prefigured for us in the experience of the Germans in 1944 to 1947-48. Their nations and homelands were stolen from them, and they were driven out. This was genocide, and the way it was done is quite instructive to what we can expect from the very same enemies today, the extreme-left Jewish communist oligarchs led by the international bankers in Wall Street. But they had our own people duped into killing each other. As you listen to tonight's program, think about how close we are to the same treatment that Germans received. And many of we are from the very people who agreed with what was done to Germany then. But we live and learn. We should look back only to clear up past misunderstandings and help us move forward with greater intelligence and freedom from being foolish followers of evil leaders. Please remember that these evil leaders are, for the most part, not the ones we were or are told were evil. So, once again, I'm pleased to present Dr. Andreas Westerle and the rest of his first-hand account of what Germans lived through from 1945 to 1952, at which time Andreas and his parents emigrated to the United States. We begin with a question from me. So, beginning in 1946, let's say, right, where were you and what was your family doing and what did you do throughout that year?
45. Well, it was more or less a continuum from for many, many months, for about a year. There was no school from about December of 1945, November of 1944, even December of 1944 until December of 1945. There was no school. Because, number one, because of the air raids, and also because after the end of the war, of course, all these large buildings were occupied by American troops, you know. And then when the Americans left, then we were able to occupy the school buildings. So for a while, for a few months, I went to grade school. It might have been in February or March of 1946, because many of these buildings had been wrecked by the American soldiers, and they were not exactly very civilized. And they used the doors, for instance, for targets to throw their bayonets at it, and each door was covered with God knows how many, 100, 200 slashes from bayonets, you know, because these boys were throwing their bayonets at the door, and they wrecked all of the glass equipment and the labs and all that stuff, all that had to be replaced at a time when there was nothing to be had anywhere in Germany. Then in September of 1946, I went back to high school, because in most European countries, high school lasts for about 8 or 9 years, you know, from the age of 10 or 11 on until the age of 19 or 20, you attend high school. It's not like the American high school, at least it was not until a few decades ago. Anyway, so in September of 46, I went to this humanistic high school, or classical high school, the way it had been before 1945 or 1933. And then there we learned, you know, Latin and English. Those were our main languages. And then the other side, the more so-called humanistic high school, who also went to the same school building with us, they also had ancient Latin, not only ancient Latin, we did also have ancient Latin, but they had ancient Greek, which we did not. Our main languages were English and Latin, and their main languages were Latin and Greek, and English was in third rank at that time in 1946. It was all rather confusing, I'm sure. There were no textbooks, you know, because all of the publishing firms had been bombed out or destroyed, and then they all had to reapply for licenses with the American military government. And so giving those licenses would take a long time. And at first, 1945 and 46, the communists were given the nod. In other words, many of the American occupiers were friendly towards the communists, and they gave them first choice in publishing textbooks, you know.
Gosh.
Which was all in line with the real power behind the American occupiers, which was not Washington, D.C., but New York and Wall Street.
Okay, and so you didn't have textbooks. So what about the teachers? Were the teachers good?
Many of the teachers, of course, only slowly came back from the various prisoners of war camps, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, many of them were dead. But I remember the wife of one of the former English and German teachers in high school taught us English and German, and she was quite good.
Hmm.
Until he came back from prison of war camp. There were these millions of expellees, you know, from Czechoslovakia and Hungary and Poland, Yugoslavia, Romania, all those places. And among them, there were also quite a few teachers, the ones that survived. And some of these teachers were then employed in grade schools and high schools.
Who paid the teachers' salaries?
I would guess it was the Bavarian state, because the state government was established in Bavaria in 1946 by the American occupation authorities.
Yeah.
And at that
and the
time,
Bavarian government was one of the better ones, wasn't it?
Right.
So again, you were in one of the better places to be. But
yeah.
Were you still in the same little village that you arrived in?
No, we moved to a different town about 7-8 miles away. That's where my father became manager of the tannery, you know.
Oh, yeah.
And that's where we stayed. And I had to take the train from this town, which had about 12,000 population, kind of small, to the county seat, which was about 9 or 10 miles to the southwest towards Regensburg. And I took the train every day, and a whole bunch of other kids took the train every day for 6 days a week. At that time, we also had school on Saturday. The only day off was Sunday.
Mm-hmm. And
we
so
also had, we had a lot of homework to do. There were about, well, depending on what semester it was, but as a beginner, say in fall of 1946, we had about 6 lessons per day, 6 days a week. Then afterwards, we had to take the train home. And once we were home, we had to do homework for maybe 5 hours a day.
And why? How did they manage to come back to such a rigorous curriculum after all that war and devastation? You know, I mean, well, of course, it wasn't that long a period of time, because Germany was functioning very well for up until, you know, beginning of 45, and then things started maybe falling apart. So then a year later, yeah, you know, it was just a year break. But how really, it's kind of amazing how they could pull together and have such good schooling going on. And how did you function then with no textbooks? Did the teachers provide you with their own written materials?
Yeah, the teacher provided their own curriculum and so on, you know. Yeah.
Wow. That's really a devotion, isn't it?
Yeah. Another thing is, there was no electricity for about the first, I've forgotten how many months it took, but for many months there was no electricity whatsoever, and we had to use not candles, because candles were too expensive, but we used these lard lights to...
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah, because we couldn't afford... There were no candles, period. There were no candles, because candles are made from wax, and wax was unattainable. So we used lard lights to light our homework, you know, all that stuff. Yeah. And then after a few months, there was electricity for maybe 2-3 hours a day. And that went on for quite a few years, until at least until 1947-48.
What kind of place did you live in after you moved to this other town?
Well, this other town, we lived in a, quite a nice apartment. In a, an inn, you know, a three-floor inn on the main square in that particular town, which was quite nice.
Good.
We also had a cat, which was also nice, you know, and we all lived together. And grandma then lived with us. My grandmother lived with us in our apartment. And the people that lived with us a few months before that, in the village, where at first we had only one room for 9 people, and then afterwards we moved. In other words, my aunt, my uncle, my cousins, and all those moved into Hesse, which was about 150, 200 miles north of where we lived.
Oh, and then why did they move there? They found, somebody found employment or something?
Yeah, right.
Okay.
My older cousin, the one who was 8 years older than me at that time, then she was 19,
mm-hmm.
and she got a job as a secretary in a hospital in Kassel. And she was especially trained for that, because she had gone to a so-called ladies' vocational college, you know. So
okay.
She got the job at the high school, excuse me, at the hospital in Kassel in northern Hesse. And then her parents moved along, and then they lived in this town in northern Hesse near Kassel.
And so how, in what way did your diet improve after, into 1946 and 1947?
Well, as I said, when my father got the position as a manager, he allowed these peasants to come in with their hides, cow hides and calf hides, and these hides were tanned for the peasants free of charge, I believe. And then the peasants gave my father bread and butter and milk and possibly meat and stuff like that. So,
Did you have some meat in your meals at that time, finally?
And then in 1946, slowly we had some, I remember one time some peasant bartered, you know, in this way, half a sheep or maybe half a lamb. This was why we're still living with our aunts and uncles and cousins and all that. And they took this mutton and pickled it. It was pickled mutton in a barrel. Right. And we ate nothing for about half a year. We ate nothing but mutton. After a few weeks, I couldn't look at the damn thing anymore, you know.
Yeah.
I really hate mutton anyway. That was the only thing we had. There was no meat, and so we just ate this mutton for months.
Did you eat it kind of knowing that you needed it for you needed the protein, or were you so hungry that, you know, you could eat it?
Oh, at that time we didn't think about protein. No, we just ate because it was meat. Yeah, right.
Okay. So with all this, you were probably one of the more fortunate of the refugees.
Right.
Yeah, because, well, you know, your father had a very good background, management background. Your family had a good background, and so you had talents and abilities that, you know, you could be used. I imagine a lot of people were a lot worse off and stayed worse off. We have, you know, the people living up in the cities in these underground cellars, you know.
Totally bombed out,
Yeah, nothing. I don't know.
And another thing was, this town where my father was manager, it's called Furt. It's one of the main gates or passes or whatever you want to call transition points from Bavaria across the Bohemian forest into Bohemia or into what was then Czechoslovakia. And so many of these German expellees from Czechoslovakia were driven out. They came in as usual, you know, with the cattle wagons, they could only take 25 pounds or 50 pounds of their property along with them, even if the property was worth millions and millions of dollars, you know. They all had to leave all that behind and only take 25 pounds or 50 pounds. And in this town in Furt, on the other side of the railroad station, a expellee camp was built for these people to catch them and to sort them out and get their personnel files and all that jazz. But of course, all that took years. And so a cousin of my mother's came along from Slovakia with her two old parents who were around, I don't know, 75, and her little son who was 5 at that time, I believe. And the brother-in-law, and they lived together with them, whatever it was, 100 other people that lived in those barracks in this expellee camp on the other side of the train station. And, of course, they slept in bunk beds, and I suppose that the lady slept with her son in one bunk bed. The other bunk bed was occupied by her parents.
Mm-hmm.
Or maybe one of her parents, and the third bunk bed was occupied by the old lady, I suppose, and then the brother-in-law had the fourth bunk bed, and that entire area was about 6 by 9 feet, something like that, and there were 5 or 6 people living in the area. Mm-hmm. That measured about 6 by 9 feet, with bunk beds on either side, and they had blankets to sort of establish privacy towards the other people who were living on the other side, you know.
Yeah.
And everything stank to high heaven. There was no running water. There was no well, there might have been running water, cold water in some tap outside of the barracks. They had to walk maybe 50 meters to get some cold water. But there were no toilets except for one huge dump where they went. There was just a big hole in the ground, a ditch in the ground.
No privacy?
No privacy whatsoever.
Yeah.
And they had, there was a wooden ramp next to the ditch, and they sat down on this ramp and just did their business into the ditch.
Yeah.
And everybody could see that. And we saw that on our way to school, because we had to take the train from that station. We looked out the window. We could see these ladies going to the toilets, you know, in this mm-hmm. huge outdoor privy. And this went
And, you know, these privy. Conditions were, the Germans lived under worse conditions on purpose, you know, purposely made to.
That's right.
Well, it wasn't all on purpose, but, you know, in some ways. Than the prisoners in these camps that they had.
Right.
That the Germans
That's
had
right.
during the war. I mean, they didn't. This is what gets me. I just.
Yeah.
Okay. When did the denazification start? Or did, you know, when did you notice that and what, how was that carried out where you lived?
It must have started in 1946, I suppose, when the Bavarian state government was allowed to be established by the general American authorities. Then probably the whole darn thing started.
Yeah.
By the way, there's a very interesting book and a fascinating book written about this whole thing by a German called Ernst von Salomon, like Solomon, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Ernst von Salomon, you've probably read it.
No.
Called Der Fragebogen, The Questionnaire. The Questionnaire.
No, I never even heard of it.
Well, get a hold of it if you can. Ernst, like Ernest, von, V-O-N, Solomon, Der Fragebogen, which is the questionnaire, which
yeah.
really details his life as a journalist and as a writer with his common law wife, who happened to be Jewish, and all the things that we went through. And he was stuck into an American concentration camp in outside of Regensburg on the Danube.
Mm-hmm.
When conditions were really very bad, too. So anyway, the whole thing's very interesting.
Well, what is he basically? He just tells about the conditions that he was living under?
Right, right.
Uh-huh.
And the entire
system.
Disorganization and chaos and all that, you know, and the conditions of those days.
Mm. So you didn't have it that bad, but you could see what others were doing. But what about denazification in your school?
Well, we were all small kids, so we didn't have to go through that, you know.
Okay, but then did they have? What about the what was allowed to be taught and so on? Did they have? You didn't have courses like about how evil the National Socialists were, or you know, any kind of that sort of preaching?
Oh yeah, we did. There was a lot of propaganda, you know, pro Allied propaganda and all that stuff.
And now, what were you and your other students there? What was your real reaction to that? Maybe not to what you said, but
what
did you think of it?
Well, we knew that part of that was just, if not lies or wholesale lies, at least greatly exaggerated, as Mark Twain used to say. You know, the mm-hmm. news of my death is greatly exaggerated.
Yeah.
And then the propaganda was pretty much in the same level. And it still is, you know. So.
Mm-hmm. Did you talk about any of these things at home among your family? Did family members talk, or did they just keep quiet and everybody knew what they had to do?
Well, most of the time, I suppose we're quiet. And, you know, we associated with our friends, people from German ex-police from Slovakia and their particular town and so on. And on Sundays, we always went for a walk because the entire town is surrounded by hills and forests, so it's very attractive. And mm-hmm. we went for walks every Sunday, you know, and stuff like that. So it wasn't too bad.
We'll take a break now and return shortly.
We'll be right back with more on the Heretics Hour. You're listening to VOR, ReasonRadioNetwork.com.
Angela Merkel said recently that multiculturalism had failed. It sparked wide public debate and put the issue of immigration firmly in the spotlight. Well, here to talk to us more about this issue, we're joined by Wolfgang Bosbach, also a member of the Christian Democratic Union, part of the coalition leading political party in Germany. Thank you very much for joining us. When the Chancellor said that multiculturalism had failed, what did she mean by multiculturalism?
Angela Merkel stated that multiculti failed because in Germany we have too much coexistence rather than togetherness, and there are only a few examples of successful integration. There are millions of examples of successful integration, but there are too many examples of refusals and failures. Integration is so important for the improvement of life perspectives of immigrants in Germany. That's why we should not live separately next to each other, so to speak multiculti, but together.
The debate has focused on Muslim immigrants rather than Polish, Italian, Greek population here in the country. Is that fair to highlight them as part of this problem?
We've always had immigration in our history. We have immigrants today and will always have them in the future. 300 years ago, every third Berliner and Brandenburger was a French Protestant. 100 years ago, Polish immigrants came to work in mining and steel industries in the Ruhr area. But in recent years and decades, people from other cultural backgrounds came. For instance, from Turkey, Northern Africa and Arabic countries. And a long time ago, we understood that these people have far bigger problems integrating than those who come from our neighbouring European countries.
So when we talk about integration, what are your party actually planning to do to help integrate people who clearly aren't at the moment?
First of all, it's the task of the people coming here to integrate themselves into society. One can't come to Germany, sit down and say, "Government, please integrate me." Instead, one has to make an effort to become part of this accepting society, and the state has to make offers to make integration work, especially language courses. Hundreds of thousands have visited language courses over recent years. This is a very encouraging result.
But with top politicians addressing this issue of immigration in the way that they have, and with the very strong wording that they've used, do you not think that this has tapped into people's often deep prejudices about immigration and about the Islamic religion that they're actually pretty ignorant about?
I don't think that harsh words were used, but rather the right words. Sensible politics begins with looking at the reality. In this reality, there are millions of examples of the best kind of integration, but there are also too many examples of failing and refusing to integrate. And the statistics say that the rate of unemployment among immigrants is double the average among the population. The quota of those receiving welfare among immigrants is three times as high as among the population. And it makes no sense talking around this issue. One must call things as they are, in reality. One cannot say, "I find the system of local benefits in Germany very good, but not the rule of law." Those who come to Germany must respect the law, the constitution, and our cultural traditions.
Could you clarify where the lines are being drawn and what will be accepted in this country and what won't be? And also your views on the argument that's now heated up on the back of this between assimilation and integration.
We'll be right back.
return to the Heretics Hour, brought to you by VOR, ReasonRadioNetwork.com.
Welcome back, everyone. I'm Carolyn Yeager. We return to Dr. Andreas Wesserle speaking about the currency reform of 1948. All right, so you are continuing. So let's say, what by 1950, what was happening?
Well, then in 1948, there was a so-called currency reform. The old mark, the Reichsmark, was abolished. This was done, of course, through the power of the American occupation authorities. But the main advisor was a famous economics advisor, Ludwig Erhard. Erhard, and after 1949, became economics minister of the federal German government, and then after Adenauer was forced to resign in 1963, I believe, Erhard became chancellor of the Federal Republic of Germany. However, he was not a very good politician, and he was not as crafty as Adenauer, and Erhard was primarily extremely scared of the retaliation on the part of the occupation authorities, so they pretty much had their way with him, you know. He would, and really, it's happened from then on until the present, you know. They would just indicate their wishes, and the German politicians would fall on their knees and kiss their shoes. Yes, 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 we'll do it.
Yeah, and, I mean, Adenauer seems to have been the only good one, really, and he still had some feeling about that Germany was not to be just totally, you know, turned into a slave state, and so he tried and he negotiated as much as he could. But after that, you say, it just it was like a puppet government or something.
Right.
Yeah.
Adenauer tried to prevent, even though he couldn't primarily do so by himself, but he would try to, not exactly prevent, but direct off over to one side, or the so-called demontage and
the demagogues,
No, not the demagogues, but the British and the French and the Russians also. They come into the Western sectors and they mount, they would rip everything off the foundations. All the plants, the machines.
The Americans didn't do that, you don't think?
The Americans did that to such an extent, especially as far as patents are concerned.
Science and secrets and stuff. Yeah.
So yeah, the best stuff was gathered by the Americans, you know.
But they weren't trying to take plants and stuff like that because they're too far away anyway, and they didn't need them.
Right. But the British and the French and the Russians took all these advanced type of machines, machinery and apparatus and all that stuff, and shaped it all back. And in Russia, it rusted. They didn't know what to do with it. They parked it somewhere in Ukraine or in southern Russia, outside of some industrial town like Kharkov or someplace. And the whole thing just rotted. It rusted to pieces.
Yeah.
They didn't know what to do with it.
Yeah,
and
greedy,
anyway,
greedy.
Of course, at that time, the German workers who were employed in these plants, they were being demounted. Translation were being ripped out by the British and the French, the Russians, and so on. Mm-hmm. Went on strike and they protested against their plants being shipped off to Britain and France and all that stuff. So, in punishment for that, General Clay was the commander of the American zone. He right away lowered the daily ration, which was extremely low to begin with, the ration that we're supposed to get on our ration cards, you know, those little food stamps. he lowered it down to 1,000 calories per day as punishment, which meant that under circumstances, most people would only get something like 700 calories per day, you know.
And a lot, how long can you live on that? I don't know. That. I can't even imagine.
You can't.
Millions, like fasting.
Of them, millions of them died of starvation.
Yeah.
Millions. There was a an American Red Cross nurse who lived in Racine, outside of Milwaukee, Racine, Wisconsin. And about, unfortunately, I don't know exactly when it was, 20 or 25 years ago, she told the journalist from the Milwaukee Journal, the main paper here, she told them that in the winter of 1946 in West Berlin, and the three sectors of Western Berlin, 100 children died per day. 100 children died per day in 1946.
Yeah, I read things like that. You know, I read some of these books, and you can't remember it. You know, you forget about it, but bring it back. I mean, it's just that's why nobody wants to hear about it, because they don't want to face up to what was done.
Right.
It was awful, and they have pictures of German children. It's absolutely skin and bones. And then all they want to show you are pictures from concentration camps of children looking like that. Although these children had a disease. They were diseased. These German children were simply starved.
That's right.
Yeah. It wasn't disease that had wasted them away like that.
Yeah.
It's, Well, okay, so when did things start to look up for you? Or do you have some more stories to tell about in between time?
Well, as I said, then after 1948, with the currency reform, everybody lost, well, not everybody, not the shareholders, but the average German, what little savings he had in the old Reichsmark was all destroyed. Was no longer valid, and you could only keep. I've forgotten what it was. Was it 40 marks for the entire family? And then you were forced to begin with those 40 marks and save up, you know, and stuff like that.
Jeez.
But anyway,
just bring everybody into poverty. So, what was that Deutschmark? Was that what took the place of the Reichsmark?
Right, that was the Deutschmark, right?
And people, which eventually became very strong.
That's right, because of the work power, the work ethic of the German population,
right.
And they sort of slowly, rung by rung, climbed up to a semi-human existence by, say, 1950, 1951, you know.
Yeah, and you can be sure that nobody gave them anything. I'm not saying there weren't some generous donations here and there, but, you know, they did it all themselves. I mean, they got through all that. And most groups get all kinds of help, and they still can't function properly. Yeah.
So went to Britain and to France, but they...
Right. I'm sure you heard all the time about the suffering of the Brits during those years. Britain, the bombing. London. All the people that, all the help they need. And then France was destroyed. Well, a lot of France was destroyed by the Allies coming through.
Yeah. all the bombing, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
London or England itself was not hit very strongly, you know, at all.
No. But you'd think that they were. Maybe that's all you heard about.
Yeah, all of the propaganda.
Yeah. So what I was going to say, when did things get better? They actually didn't really get better, because the country became sunk deeper and deeper into propaganda as time went on. You know, right at the beginning, you all still had your correct thinking, you know, at least, even though you couldn't say anything, but... But as time went on, then people started to believe all this stuff.
Yeah.
the Germans. Did you notice that? I mean, was that a topic or anything that the people, Germans around you, were starting to, were changing and were believing?
Well, not at that time, but they came later.
Okay.
Especially then when the socialists, the social democrats, who unfortunately voted into power in 1969 with American help, actually. And of course, the socialists, at least the leading socialists, for over a century, since the 19th century, the socialists always propagandized against the nation state and against nation as such, in favor of proletariat of the world, arise. You have nothing but a chance to lose,
yeah.
You know. But they modified it slightly, so they wouldn't offend the Americans. But from 1969 on, all this anti-national propaganda became stronger and stronger under the aegis of the socialists, which, of course, was supported by the American occupation authorities and the Brits and the French and the Russians and so on.
So the Social Democratic Party came into being basically made up of the of communists, huh?
Well,
or it's just also a lot of people who are just looking for the best advantage or something. I don't know.
Yeah, but you know, in the 19th century, there was no distinction between communists and socialists. And the communists only then sort of seceded from the socialist movement and founded their own movement and tried to create a revolution, a bloody revolution in Berlin and Hamburg and Munich and various other large cities in 1918 and 1919, but they didn't succeed. And from then on, roughly from 1918, 1919 on, there was a separate communist movement and a separate social democratic movement.
So then up until 1952, you were just mostly, the people were just trying to come back through their own efforts,
right.
And so on. And
exactly.
So what caused you to make the decision to emigrate to the United States, you and your family?
Well, I don't know for sure myself, but the thing is, you know, my father, when things were so bad in 1946, he applied to emigrate to the United States, to Chicago, because many of his relatives were lived at that time in Chicago. They still do, matter of fact. But at that time, no German was allowed to emigrate to the United States. In contrast to the so-called displaced persons, who were mostly, you know, Poles or Ukrainians, Lithuanians, God knows who, but
and Jews, and they and, were
they were favored all along, but then when the Bonn Republic was established, you know, Federal Republic of Germany, and then the Soviet zone, the so-called Democratic Republic of Germany, Senator Langer of South Dakota, I believe, either North, I think it was in South Dakota. He was a Russian-German, because there are many Russian-Germans in North Dakota, South Dakota, Nebraska. Like Lawrence Welk. Lawrence Welk was a Russian-German. And the Senator Langer, then with some of his colleagues in the Senate, pushed through a law saying that these ethnic Germans from East Central Europe and from Eastern Europe could emigrate to the United States. And that happened around 1950, around that time. 50, 51.
Ooh, okay.
And then, all of a sudden in 1952, we received a letter from the American consulate general in Munich, I believe, saying that we could now emigrate to the United States, but all would happen, what has to happen in the space of a couple of months. So, of course, we didn't know what to do exactly. But at that time, well, it's a long story. So my father got pretty sick of it, and he decided to emigrate to Chicago.
Your father wasn't that old. Your parents weren't that old at that time. What did your father manage to come up with after you got into the Chicago?
Well, he was old in American eyes. He was 50 at that time.
Yeah.
And, of course, that's, I mean, at that time when you were 50, you were considered senile.
Yeah, you're right. Yeah.
There were people trying to help you across the street and stuff like that. And of course, he was extremely strong, intelligent. He spoke six languages, but all that didn't do any good. And yeah, he didn't get a job he wanted. Of course, he wanted to be either the department head or manager of some tannery where he knew the business, but he couldn't get a job, so he had to work in the factory for a while, for a number of months. My mother also worked in the factory, which was unheard of, because where we came from, if a woman worked in a factory, that's the same thing as prostitution.
Okay.
If you worked in a factory, you were a prostitute.
Huh.
So, and that often, it's actually true. You know, I worked in factories too, and I saw how these ladies worked, how these ladies, so-called ladies, behaved towards their male department heads. You know, they were done anything to get a better job. And I mean anything, even though most of them were married. So anyway,
well,
my mother had to work in his factory in Chicago, radio and whatchamacallit.
Factory. Motorola? Was it Motorola?
Motorola. It was Motorola.
Yeah. And so what, how were you, how old were you then? And you were you finished with high school in Germany then and ready to start?
Right. And I entered in September of 1952, I entered a, what was then called a junior college on the north side of Chicago, which was very nice, small, very attractive campus, North Park College, now it's called North Park University.
Mm-hmm.
Very nice little university and so on. And I was there for two semesters. And of course, I also had to work, you know, got summer jobs, which was not terribly attractive for us because the weather was just downright hellish, you know, in Chicago.
Yeah, for you.
At least at that time.
Yeah.
The average temperature was around 100 degrees from June until the end of September, you know.
Oh, no.
And, well, you know.
Not that high. but it's different. It's different than where you are from. It's a lot cooler where, over there in Europe.
And then a year later, he got a job in a chemical laboratory. It was more like a laboratory in Milwaukee. A lab which specialized in producing dyes and artificial dyes and artificial resins for tanneries. And since he knew a lot about that, he got a job in this particular lab in Milwaukee, which does not exist anymore. It was close to the Schlitz Brewery, which also does not exist anymore. But anyway, So
you moved to Milwaukee.
And we moved to Milwaukee, right? And then I entered the university, Marquette University in Milwaukee, right?
Okay, so, well, I think we're going to have to stop for now, Dr. Wesley, and continue on another day. So is there any thoughts about what we've covered today that you'd like to bring up?
Well, it's extremely difficult for people who are living under more or less normal circumstances, you know, say in the USA or many other countries, to put yourself under those conditions and circumstances as they prevailed in, say, 1944, 45, 46, 47, 48, 49, because it was really extremely chaotic and disconcerting, to say the least, you know.
Do you think it left, what did it leave any permanent marks, or what did it leave on you and your the rest of your family?
Well, I don't know. It left a very strong desire for survival, you know.
Okay.
And,
well, That's
probably other remarks too. But then, you know, I also noticed also with some of my relatives and uncles, like one of my uncles who was a Jesuit in Hungary, and the communists stuck him into prison for 14 years, and he never talked about it himself. And I noticed that these people who have been through hell don't talk about it, you know. And these people who make a big to-do about it, oh, how terrible, how terrible. Actually, did not go through anything like that. It's all fantasy. It's all imagination.
Well, what do you think of the the Jewish survivors who don't say anything until 50, 60 years later, and then they write a book about all of it?
Well, it's very how shall we say, questionable, you know.
Yeah.
It contains a lot of imagination, a lot of fantasy. My mother met a Jewish lady on the bus here in Milwaukee, on the municipal bus, going to some sales, you know, shopping centers, stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
And this Jewish lady, well, she originally was in Tsarist Russia, and she survived the pogroms in Russia because they hid underneath the skirt of her grandmother when they were little kids. And then they moved to Poland, and then in Poland, when Germany occupied Poland, at some time after that, they were herded into concentration camps. But she said, she told my mother that this was about 30, 40 years ago, that conditions were not at all like those as they're portrayed on TV. What they said, tell you on TV, does not correspond to the truth. That's what the Jewish lady told my mother, see. Now, unfortunately, my mother didn't ask her which concentration camp she was in, whether it was Auschwitz or not. And this Jewish lady would do the laundry and maybe put in some buttons on the uniform of the SS officers. And they would give her extra, you know, extra food and extra positive help. And she said it was not bad. Life in that concentration camp where she was not bad.
I would like to ask that lady if she would be willing to say that, you know, in a public way, or if she'd be able to make that statement.
I doubt it very much, because she'd be attacked immediately, you know, by...
Yes, by her fellow Jews.
Yeah, extremely incensed and daring to tell the truth, you know.
Yeah, well, that's very, very interesting. Too bad she didn't say she was in Poland, so maybe she was in one of the camps. Very likely could have been in Auschwitz, but there are several other camps she could have been in.
That's right.
Well, okay, what a way to end up. Okay, well, we will, I thank you so much for your time today, and
You're very welcome.
Well, thank you. I'm very happy with being able to talk to you. And so we will say goodbye for now and pick it up at a later time.
Thank you.
Thank you. And to you, the listeners, thanks for tuning in to the Heretics Hour again, and come back next week. I will have a different kind of program next week, but there are many topics of great interest that Dr. Wesselet is very knowledgeable about, such as international military tribunals that were conducted during the later 40s, the most important and well-known being the Nuremberg proceedings against the major war criminals. These topics will be coming up in the future. So stay with the Heretics Hour and VOR, and you will learn a lot. And visit www.elieweaseltattoo.com, too. Good night.
Thanks for listening. The Heretics Hour returns Monday evening, 9 p.m. Eastern U.S. time. Join us at ReasonRadioNetwork.com.